Good morning, everyone, and welcome. I'm Karen Kuttner. I'm with Lindblad Expeditions, and I am delighted to be moderating today on a near and dear topic to my heart, cruise trends, ships, and services. It's really a mouthful to say, but it's loaded with a really hot topic, one that is clearly near and dear to everybody's heart, because it really takes a look today at the cruise trends, the landscape of where we're going, what we can expect, and quite honestly, we're at a huge turning point in the industry right this second. And I think, by a show of hands, how many people have been sort of watching what's in the news about where we're going with ships? So as I look around, a very seasoned group of people that's watching it, but I thought it may be valuable to share a few really interesting statistics. The cruise ship order book is breaking records right now. They're saying right now, 2018 has opened up with 94 cruise ships on order between now and 26. So I'm just going to repeat that. 94 new cruise ships will be underway. Of those, 23 of those 94 ships are expedition new builds. And I'm going to repeat that. 23 new expedition new builds are being built as we speak. Doesn't include acquisitions or people who are having ships that have already been on the waters for some time, but brand new ships. So that makes 2019 the record year that they're seeing with berth introductions, with 24 ships in 2019 to be coming onto the waters. So it's a mouthful to digest. It's a different time and place for all of us that have been in the industry for so long. We're going to take a look at what does this mean for our future, particularly how it impacts the industry as a whole, and for all of us here in the room in the affinity market. What can we expect from that? And what can we surmise? And I'm not sure that we as a group have all of the answers, but together as a group, and hopefully with your input, we can begin to surmise and brainstorm together of what we might see and envision. So what we're going to do today, we have an esteemed group of panelists that I'm thrilled to be here with. We're going to talk a little bit, each person's going to take a different role, but we're going to talk a little bit about the ship design and what we're starting to see as we move forward in terms of how ships are being built from hulls, bows, stabilizers, seaworthiness, and direction with onboard amenities. We're going to look at all of these new ships and where they're going to be, because as we know, there's just so many places in the world that we can be at this point. So what kind of impact does that have on itinerary development and on impact on tourism to locations and impact on your traveler's experience as well? We're also going to be hearing today from a conservation standpoint of having all of these new ships on the waterways. What will that do, or what can we envision could happen as a result of the impact on the water? And then we're going to open up to everyone here in the room, because we really want, this is going to be an interactive session, and we really want to get your thoughts on how we see this may or could impact the affinity market. It could impact in terms of space allocations. It could be impacting in terms of pricing, and that would be an interesting topic to talk a little bit more about. And it could open up lots of different avenues, and I think would be a great thing to address. So to start us off here, I'm going to make some introductions right to my immediate right, or to, let's see, to your left, Yannis Vontis. He's with Variety Cruise Lines. Many of you have worked with him in the past. He's a senior partner. Danielle Nedzella, he is with Ponant. He's the senior advisor. Many of you have heard or have worked with him as well. Peter Morell Hansen is with Arctic Expeditions as the president. And Sam Whitcraft, and she is with, I'm going to say this correctly, Director of Conservation and Outreach for Oceans for Youth. Thank you. We're going to start off with Danielle, because I know that you're going to be talking more about the direction of ship design. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Hello, everybody. So So my name is Daniel Nezzella, as you say. I am from Pono in France. That explains my bad accent. I'm sorry about that. You know, better for expedition than for English language in France, you know. So first of all, I want to thank you all for coming to this session. I know this educational travel because we work on the. I work for you for more than 20 years. That's why I know a lot of people coming today. What we can say, that's true that the market for educational travel has evolved in the last 20 years. There is some fundamental elements which remain constant. These elements include affinity to belong to an institution of learning well beyond the years at school, sharing its purpose and value, a strong passion for learning throughout one life from scholar and expert to broaden one's own thinking. So, where do small ships fit in? They provide the ease of travel without packing and unpacking throughout the journey in global destination. But much more than that, they facilitate discussion, debate, and discourse among a small group of individuals and built an experience of lifelong learning, both on board and ashore, that is unmatched. A large group risks diluting the meaning and purpose of educational travel, and having the venue for formal structure and informal discussion is very important to build that affinity to institution. All small ships need to have facility to seat all guests for lecture, having theater, and also, you know, using all this space for special events like being in Antarctica, like crossing the Corinthian Canal, you know. We think it's important that we have comfort for the people. Today's client is looking for experiences we coincide with their increased consciousness and sustainability and for responsible travel. While expeditions are not new to the travel market, small ships provide a superb opportunity to explore fragile and sensitive regions of the world on a specialty design expedition cruise ship. I think there is 24 or 25 ships under construction now. Sensitive environments are best suited for small ships, as well as the use of the modern technology to minimize the environmental impact of visit to this area. It's very important to know that undertaking expedition requires tremendous training and experience for the crew. And partnering with scientific community to provide access and enable them to carry out research. Cruising larger ship risk overcrowding sensitive area and alter the environment with less impact. We preserve better what we know well. An expedition is by no means a simple bucket list item for tourists, I think. Now, why all these elements seem constant and unchanged for the last 20 years, there is also a great deal that is evolving and has impacted modern ship design and the increase in new ship being built. There is four emerging trends that I will briefly touch upon. First is a growing demand to explore remote destinations, such as polar region. The changing taste of the guests to expand modern-day contemporary comfort from stateroom amenity, fine dining, spa, you know, big three-star chef for the food, etc., etc. The use of technology, new Wi-Fi capacity, sustainability and traveling responsibly with respect for the environment. Remote destination. There is a strong trend in traveling to remote destination from Antarctica to the Kimberley, from polar to tropical expedition. This has propelled an upward trend in building modern small ships which can capture these elements such as those I have mentioned. Members continue to choose based on destination and the subject matter expert. However, they expect the element mentioned to be included. Traveling to such remote region require an ice class hull, and in the case of an icebreaker, significant investment in technology to have a low carbon footprint. As always, the classical world of cruising in the Med from the Aegean to the Iberian Seas remains highly popular and is making a strong comeback. As the global fleet of small ships expands, as you said before, it allows to offer a bigger portfolio of product to the travel study market. Newer destinations which are trending strongly include Japan, Iceland, Coral Triangle, and Papua New Guinea, as well as the High Arctic. The average length range between 7 and 10 days for each trip. Learning through discovery, adventure, and for subject matter expert speaker continue to remain the strongest pillar for travel to such areas. Now, shipboard design. The most important element of this is having a space like the theater with new technology to facilitate lecture for everyone traveling. Then comes other element, balcony, terraces, so you can better view the area where you are cruising while listening to an expert commentary. And last but not last, weather and navigation condition permitting, an open bridge. Also, once people have walked through mud or ice, they like to refresh with a spa treatment and enjoy a glass of Veuve Clicquot. I think. Of course, we French, so we prefer French champagne. Sorry about that. Use of technology. Of course, today we all like to stay connected despite being in remote destination. Wi-Fi on board ship, while not perfect, is significantly improved. And we work every day to make it better, about the number of megabits. We work, we have a research and design to have the most modern technology for this ship, to see and hear the surrounding in the ocean. Merchant trend in use of technology will continue to evolve. Now, sustainability. 20 years ago, we walked out the store after food shipping with a plastic glass. Today, we think and act differently. Ship owners today need to be supporters of sustainability with clean ship. This allows, for example, the ship to use dynamic position in sensitive area and have not to drop anchor and to hold the position. It equips the ship with filtration system that do not discharge black or gray water into the ocean. That's very important for us. It uses electrical propulsion on the ship. For example, LNG, compared to what you have now, which is nuclear or classical propulsion to go to the North Pole, for example. Finally, educational travel, it's all about transforming the traveler and not changing the destination or its natural history and people. That's why small ships are seeing a rising demand. Thank you for listening.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, my name is Peter. I'm from Arctic Adventure in Copenhagen, and I've been handling cruise ships in Greenland for the last 30 years. And I will start to tell you that I have a dream. I have a dream to sail from New York to Southampton on board a Cunard liner, just like they did 100 years ago. My motivation to do it is just to travel back in time. Most of the people joining up for the cruise ships today, they may have an opportunity to like the sailing, but I'm sure that most of their motivation is to see new places, have new experiences, etc. And therefore, the ships, they have more or less the same aims in what they are doing. They come to places where people want to go. And unfortunately, then there's not that much planning. So what we see many times is that too many ships come to the same place in the same time. If we're talking about big ships, then it's not the biggest problem, because if you have 10 ships in Copenhagen and 11 one come the same day, then we can take in coaches and whatever from Jutland. They have to go 2-3 hours one way, empty to drive the passengers, but it can be done. For the smaller ships, it's another question, because they will sail into areas where there is a very, very limited capacity in excursion means, in restaurants, shops, whatever. And there, it can be a disaster if we have more than one ship in the same day. Of course, my experience mainly is in Greenland and in the Faroe Islands, but I also know quite a lot of what's going on in Iceland. As you know, Iceland has increased tremendously in touristic-wise during the last 5 years. And today, you can have in Reykjavik up to 10 ships on the same time. 10 ships with around 15,000 passengers. 80% of these passengers, they do the same tour, called the Golden Circle. And if you try to find out how many coaches do you need to carry 12,000, 13,000 people on the same 280 kilometers, that is quite a lot. And now they are talking about there's a cortege, so when the first coach come, they not come two, three, four, etc. I can tell you that when I started in this business 30 years ago, in Iceland we were discussing what we could do in the future. At that time, they had 30,000 tourists a year. And everybody wanted to do the Golden Circle. Today, it's 1 million, and they still do the Golden Circle. We have tried to convince operators, planners of land arrangement, that they could go to other waterfalls than Gullfoss. There are a lot of waterfalls. They are maybe 40 kilometers more driving, but they come into areas with the same nature, old volcanoes, lava marks, whatever, but nobody knows the area, and then nobody wants to sell it. So they go back to Gullfoss and Geysir and Tingvellir. In Greenland, where we expect the smaller ships to come, there the problem is capacity. And to create an impact to the local community, if a ship comes in with tenders, with zodiacs, etc., and do excursions themselves, do their own guided trip because they're expedition leaders on board, then there's very, very little impact for the local population. And in such a situation, you can't rely on them to participate in the future in your calls. And therefore, it is my hope that in the future, there will be a more weight in planning the various calls, not just tell people in a small place in Greenland or Faroe Islands, we are coming tomorrow or we are coming next year on that day, and then hope everything will go. It won't go in the long end, at the long end, because there must be some understanding of what these small communities they need. I have a feeling, and maybe some of you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I have a weak feeling that when you design a cruise, then it is the maritime department who is the first speaker. They say we can sail like this and this and this and this, and then we will be in that port 8 hours, that port 10 hours, that port 6 hours, and that is the plan. This means that it is the tour planners for the land arrangement who have to adjust to what they are told to do. If nobody check if there is a ship in the same harbor at the same day, then we have the havoc. Then there will be problems. And I know that in some places they will start to put up frames for, on that day we only accept 100, 200, 300 people in this area. But to avoid that it will be the nature that everything have to control everything, then I really recommend that the land operators in the companies, they are allowed to come with a bigger impact on what are we going to do and when are we going to do it. They can check with their local operators if there are any ships coming that day, and then they can maybe could adjust the maritime plans so they are not coming up in the end of each other. But locally, I'm sure that most communities, they will be very happy to receive the ships if they have some benefit from it. And I'm sure that planning is, in this way, that is very imperative. We really need to start thinking a little bit ahead to see that we avoid the biggest disasters which could come up.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Giannis? Yeah.
Be repeating a bit, and definitely my presentation will have the angle, with the angle of the ship owners and how they see the future, and how we see the market. I will of course a bit repeat what other people said before me because I'm coming with three people. So first of all, three facts. Fact number one, and I think you all know that there is. The programs with the cruise component are increasingly popular. I mean, I don't have statistics. I don't know how many of the programs that the schools are coming out with include a cruise, but I have a feeling, without being sure, that there's more and more of cruises in the programs that that tour operators offer. And I think we don't need statistics, we can see it. And the fact that we have more and more ships being built also proves that there is a demand. For that. And fact number two is related to that. There is a growing demand for upscale, what I call quality cruise programs with a strong educational content. I think we all know that as well. And fact number three is, for those that have been in this business for a long time, that we, years ago, like 20, 30 years ago, the demand was satisfied by smaller ships. The company that used to own the small ships, there were 20, maximum 50 cabins, okay? But this increased demand has basically changed the market. And basically today, cruise companies like ours and many others here have a dilemma. Do we go for bigger ships? Do we order or buy bigger ships that are faster, larger, more capacity, or we stick to our guns, and we continue offering what we do today, smaller ships, either buying them or build them. So this is the dilemma, and I think we have it as ship owners, and you have it as clients, because you have to look at sometimes if you go for a bigger ship and dash bigger risk, or a smaller ship that has different characteristics. Okay, so very quickly, let's look at the trend for the larger ships. When I say, for me, a large ship, allow me to speak this way, a large ship for me is more than 100 cabins. You know, they are big ships as far as we are concerned, okay? So the pluses, the ships are larger, no question about that, they are faster, and the speed allows them to basically offer programs which are what I call multi-destination programs. A large ship will sell a program, allow for a program Venice to Istanbul, which is totally impossible for a ship that has a speed of 10 nautical miles, and this is the big difference today. Okay, and of course, they cover longer distances and they have more facilities than you'll find on a smaller ship. The ships are larger, we talk about 200 beds, 100 cabins, whatever we use as a measure, and theoretically, there is economies of scale, and theoretically, again, these are, you know, benefiting the end user, the client, and the tour operator as well. Another plus for these larger ships, and it's an important plus, is that they can be redeployed very easily. For a small ship to move from, let's say, Cuba or Costa Rica all the way back into the Med, it takes sometimes 30 to 40 days, just one way, which means that the operator, the owner, will have 70 or 80 days a year just to redeploy the ship. Okay? Whereas you take a larger ship, the newer ships, for example, like the ships of Pono, and you know, they will do the same redeployment in 15 days, and very often they'll be able even to sell the repositioning crews, which is very difficult on a smaller ship. Okay? The minuses for the ships. First of all, and that's an important factor we'll come back later on, construction cost for a large ship is much higher than on a small ship. And people have the impression that if you build 30 cabins versus 100 cabins, the cost would be three times more. Well, I have news for you. The 30 cabin ship would cost about 10 times less than the 100 cabin ship, sometimes 12 times less. It has to do with technology, with many other factors. And I think Daniel knows that even better than me. Okay. The larger ships, of course, have limitations in terms of the ports they can use, right? We just discussed it earlier. You know, Iceland, for example, the example was good. Out of Reykjavik, you really, if you're on a big ship, you really can operate only one excursion or two excursions. And you cannot go north because it's too far away. Well, if you go on a smaller port, like north of Reykjavik, which is only accessible from a small ship, then you can operate a different excursion and offer more. Okay, so this is an advantage. This is a minus for the larger ships. And of course, larger ships means maybe less personalized, less exclusivity for the clients. I mean, you have 200 passengers. Even though those big ships like to call themselves yachts, it's one question if this is a yacht or this is a small ship, this is a big ship, right? This is a question that you'll have to answer when you're on board. Now, let's look at the smaller ships, 50 cabins or less, okay? The pluses, obviously, are, as I said before, you can operate the program, which is more intricate and there's more immersion in the destination. It's a slow cruise versus the fast cruise, okay? And of course, you can see places and you can be in a port. You're in Mykonos, for example. You are in the old port of Mykonos, right in the middle of the destination. You walk out of the ship, on the small ship, and you are in a port. The port of Mykonos, the large port of Mykonos, is 3 kilometers away. You have to go in buses to go from the port into town, and you have to wait for the buses to come. It will take you probably 45 minutes to get to Mykonos. It takes 3 minutes to go from the ship into the town. Okay. And one of the pluses of the smaller ships that you with reduced capacity, it makes it easier for just one or two universities or schools to use, versus the larger ship where you as a tour operator, you have to look for very often 10, 12, 14 schools or universities to fill the charter if you took the charter risk. The minuses of the smaller ship, and this is something that everyone has to look at, and you look at that, I'm sure. Smaller capacity means basically that on a ship, for example, with 25 cabins, you're going to lose 3, 4, sometimes 5 cabins because of staff, because of lecturers, because of the university faculty. So you are left with, let's say, 75% of your capacity when you charter a smaller ship. On the other hand, this is actually obliging us or the people that build new ships, small ships, to look at, for example, adding, changing, the cabin, the cabin configuration. Maybe decide to have more singles, smaller cabins for the faculty or for the staff. Whereas today they're sitting in the regular guest cabins, which are larger and more luxurious. So this is one of the things that will affect definitely construction of small ships. And then the other minus is, of course, the speed and the size. You're not able to offer the itineraries that people are looking for, and this is, for example, we have many clients that will ask for an itinerary, which is impossible to operate with a smaller ship. We're looking for, for example, right now the Kimberley, operation, and because of issues of cabotage and everything else, that you cannot operate the program that a larger ship will operate because they have the ship, they have the speed, and they can leave Australia, reach an Indonesian port in order to get out of Australian waters and then come back. That's not possible on a small ship. This is a limitation you have when it comes to the operation, the itineraries. Mm-hmm. So, what's the right ship and the right strategy for cruise companies? I think obviously, and we can see it, some companies will go bigger, and they will continue building larger ships because of the need for them to offer more capacity. There is more demand for them. Some others will, and I see it even in the case of Lindblad. You know, they will look for slightly larger ships, but not big ships. I think you are, for mm-hmm. example, in this company, mm-hmm. this case, you are sticking to your guns, and right. we are as well. But at the end of the day, and I'm now talking as a ship owner, as a ship owning company, let's be down to earth. More than often, the decision is made on financial means you have. I mean, to build a ship, a modern, brand new ship like the ones that are coming out very fast these days, you talk about a quarter million euros, 250 million euros, 220 million euros, and that's an investment that not many companies can afford, mm-hmm. right? Unless you have big banks behind you. So the decision, we're looking at the demand in the market and the non-profit demand, but at the same time, we all, as ship owners, have to look at how much money we can afford to mm-hmm. invest in ships, and these. This is very often the base for the decision we make. You know, mm-hmm. do we invest on small and big? Mm-hmm. That's a fact of life. Okay, and you as tour operators and as clients, you look at both options. I think you look at the small ships in when you look at particular itineraries, and you look at the bigger ships. Well, because sometimes it's practical and it's easier for your company's strategies and for the marketing dollars you're spending to market mm-hmm. your ships. So mm-hmm. There's a market for smaller and bigger ships. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Yannis. We're going to have a lot of food for thought on all of these terrific topics, and Sam is going to wrap this up for us in terms of looking at the impact on the conservation before we open it up for questions and comments.
So do I need to use the mic, or can you all hear me if I use my stage voice?
No. You project well.
So just a little bit of a background on me, so lest you think I'm just a tree hugger. I've worked on ships all over the world, from big ships up in Alaska to luxury eco-tour yachts in the Coral Triangle to Clash of the Sea vessels in Cuba. So I bring that to the table along with the experience of being a research scientist and conservation biologist on those vessels and developing education programs for companies that run those ships and vessels. So I'm going to try and bring that all together.
I think they're thinking you might need this.
Yeah? Okay. Okay, so with so many choices that have just been described to you in the cruising industry, it's important, I think, to match affinity travelers' green expectations with what ships can deliver, and also get past some of the old concepts of what cruising is or was. So why is that important? Because the travelers booking educational travel or affinity travel on expeditionary ships are likely more concerned about environmental issues generally, and they're going to have higher expectations about everything, including what the environmental services that the ships are delivering. And they're seeking a more intimate experience with nature on the smaller vessels that are going to these more remote places. And because they're seeking that out, we know that that's something that they likely value highly, right? So, and I agree with what my colleague said, that for most people who go on these trips, it's more than just checking a bucket list. They're looking to reconnect with nature in a meaningful way, because that's missing for most people. And so for a lot of people, whether or not their experience, they perceive it to be green, can tarnish whether or not they feel they've had that appropriate connection with nature. The other reason it's important is because social media, where most people spend a lot of time these days, is just resplendent with videos and information and articles about environmental impacts to our oceans. So, for example, just this week, there were two viral videos that came out that highlighted results from two scientific studies on plastic in the oceans. One talked about how some scientific estimates project that by the year 2050, there'll be more plastic in the ocean than fish. And another one highlighted, took the raw scientific data from a worldwide survey of marine plastic and boiled it down to the digestible idea that the equivalent of a garbage truck full of plastic enters the oceans every second. So it's those statistics are disturbing, but it's important to know from the perspective of the industry and of educational travel that these are statistics that the general public is consuming. They know this. They see it every day on their social media feed, and that means they care about it and they feel connected to it. And even if your social media feed isn't filled with super green tree-hugging articles, let's say you're a fisherman, your news feed is going to show things like another viral video that came out about a month ago now of a fisherman off of Baja catching a wahoo, cutting it open on the deck, and it was filled with plastic bottle caps. So even if you're not super into your news feed being green, you're still getting this in your face. So I want to get back to setting the stage of what people often generally think of cruising. So up until recently, cruising didn't necessarily have the greenest image. So for example, in 2016, a major cruise line pleaded guilty to federal charges for years of illegal oil dumping that came down to 7 felony charges and a big fine. And again, that was all over the media. It was a big story. And oil has a lot of impacts in the environment. And again, people are more and more aware of this because of things like the Deepwater Horizon disaster. I was involved in research during and after that disaster. So I'll just give you a couple of things that we learned from it. The particulate oil that was part of the Gulf oil disaster was shown to cause cardiac arrest in larval fish, including endangered tuna. And so when you have a spawning area where tuna are spawning, like the Gulf, and you have an oil spill that happened at the same time as the spawning, that's going to have a major impact. The oil in the Gulf also was trapped between the shells of invertebrates and their bodies, and in particulate in little droplets, and you could actually see it under the microscope. And that was then ingested into their bodies, and we're talking about shrimp, which then go into the human food web for consumption. Now, it's important to note that not all oil interacts in the marine environment in the same ways. It depends on the density and the kind of oil, and that in the Deepwater Horizon disaster, the extraordinary amount of dispersants that was used made the oil more persistent and have more of an impact on the environment. So there are other cruise ship potential pollutants beyond oil, or the dumping of oil. There's ballast water, which many ships use, and they'll transport from one place to another and then dump the ballast. So according to the National Invasive Species Information Center, which is part of the USDA, it's estimated that 5,000 species may be transported in ballast water on any given day across our oceans, and any one of those can become the next invasive species. Gray water and black water, as it was discussed, if you don't know, you probably do. Gray water, you can simplify as basically cleaning water, and black water is usually defined by having fecal matter in it. There's chemical pollution, solid waste, air pollution, and noise pollution, which can disrupt wildlife in the water and on land. But the good news is that, I know, everyone's like, can we hear something good now? Yeah, welcome to my career. So the good news is that regulatory changes are pushing the industry in a more environmentally and environmentally friendly direction, as you heard from my colleagues, along with some amazing industry innovation. So the new smaller ships, I believe, are targeted for the expanding market, which is travelers who, according to one industry article, have a sense of urgency to see great places before it's too late, and also an increasing demand for an off-the-beaten-path sailing or ocean-going experience. And these smaller ships are built to do that and to go to more remote and pristine places. For example, icebreakers. They can break through the ice and go to places that people normally wouldn't have the opportunity to go. And some of these green innovations in the industry have already been discussed. I'll just go over them quickly. Increased fuel efficiency by design or fuel propulsion choice. Some are hybrid, some are electric. Some use LNG, liquefied natural gas, and LED lighting is more and more common. The lack of, or the move away from anchoring in pristine areas is very good news in the industry. And that's because people think of anchoring damage as coral drops on coral reefs and reefs being damaged, but the bottom of the ocean is alive almost everywhere. So dropping an anchor on anything isn't the best plan, especially in a pristine area. So the development of dynamic positioning system, my new favorite three words, is a really positive move for the industry. If you don't know what that is, it means the ship can stay on station where it needs to be without dropping an anchor. Water system recycling is coming into play in some of the ships, along with improved filtration of wastewater. And that's, as my colleague said, very important in terms of what the ships are putting into these more pristine places that they go, what's in the water that they're discharging. And then more and more ships and their launches and their zodiacs are recognizing the need for maintaining a safe distance from marine mammals. And some of the ships even use sonar 3D imaging to ensure that that takes place. But different ships have different ways of incorporating sustainable practice. And I think as planners for affinity travel and in terms of knowing what your client wants, it's important to know these and to know which ships are delivering what so that your clients do get the full green experience that then translates to a natural experience for them. So, and I wanted to touch on all of the environmental improvements and innovations that we just talked about sometimes are a little bit behind the scenes. There aren't that many travelers who are going to ask about a dynamic positioning system. But there are a few things that, in my experience, will trigger travelers in their experience while they're at sea. The first is, because it's so common now, so hot a topic, is single-use plastics. So it's really good to ask your tour operator or the ship company, does the ship use plastic straws, cups, stirrers, bags, K-cups? That's a big deal now. And for example, one of the companies that I've worked with recently launched a new yacht in Oman. And on the maiden voyage, we had a regular devoted customer who took time out of her day on her return to write to the CEO and say that she loves the company, she loves the trip, she loves the new itinerary, but was heartbroken that every night her cocktail came with a straw in it, even when she asked that it didn't. This is what stood out to her. She was on a yacht off the coast of Oman, and she wrote to the executive director about straws. Sunscreens. It's good to ask a ship or a tour company if they've taken into consideration oxybenzones. Am I out of time?
You know what? I love hearing about this. I think what we want to do is...
I can wrap it up if you give me a
minute.
No, you
know what? Because you have... Yeah, if you only because there are so many things and you have so many great topics, but I want to make sure we cover it all.
Yep, so, I'll wrap
great.
It up.
Thanks.
So, quick list. These are the things that it might be worth asking your tour operator or ship owner, ship company about. Sunscreens, whether or not they're provided, whether or not there's a policy about them on board. I can talk to you later about the impacts of sunscreen. Recycling. All ships pretty much recycle now, but the question is, in these more remote locations, recycle to where? Many remote locations in developing countries don't have the facilities to recycle what's brought to them for recycling. Animal disturbance. We talked about how that's being addressed now. But it's important that you know whether or not the company you're booking with has a strict policy on that so that people feel comfortable. Trampling impacts, that has to do with where people walk for the first time or repeatedly in places where vegetation isn't accustomed to that. Are there set paths so that we don't create a beaten path for people who want to be off the beaten path? And then ask about whether or not cruising destinations have limits for landings. So places that do are like Antarctica, part of the Galapagos, Gardens of the Queen, Cuba, limit the number of people who can go ashore to limit those impacts on wildlife and vegetation. And then I guess I'll leave you with this thought. As our keynote speaker, Ron McGill, noted, people who take these trips want to make a difference, to be part of something positive. And that's why it's important to connect what your travelers' green expectations are with what the yachts or vessels or ships may be delivering. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, I don't know about you, but I think there is so much food for thought. You all have brought a tremendous amount of different angles that I think in making any decisions now, do we go for the big ship? Do we go for the small ship? Are they green? What impact do they have? There's just so many choices to consider. But I think what I heard as a stream from all, really everybody, is we're hearing the trend towards remote. People want something different. They want something impactful. They want something different. And at the same time, you know, as the ships get larger, we are heading in some of the same directions. The world is small. And so how do we handle that? You know, what impact does that have on the travelers, on your constituency when you're out there? If we have, you know, 20 ships in Iceland, what does that look like for their experience and what feedback are you getting back? And so I want to open this up to everybody here. We have a seasoned group of people here in the room, and I don't know that we all know the answers to the direction we're going to see the future landscape, but kind of opening up to kind of say, where do we think it's going, and what impact do we think this is going to have as we make decisions as planners and operators going forward? So I'll pass around the mic. And if you could just say your name and your organization as well, because it's a nice intimate room, we can do that.
Unfortunately, but probably fortunate for you, I've been losing my voice. my name is Todd Nielsen. I'm with AO Study Tours. We manage several nonprofit travel programs for long term. One, a comment and then a question. A comment, Giannis is making a sort of fine distinction that a 100 cabin ship is a large ship. In my view, a 100 bed ship in the nature of things is a rather small ship. The problems, I think, which were addressed by the last speaker are really these huge cruise liners with 1,000 cabins, 2,000 cabins, now even approaching 3,000 cabins. They have a lot more straws in their ships than all the small ships combined. Now, I do agree with Giannis that a 20-cabin ship is very different from a 100-cabin ship, but I just wanted to make that distinction. The cruise liners are not represented here. So that's one point. The second thing, though, I want to address Peter's point. I was at the founding of the International Antarctica Tours Operator Association, I think it was 1988. Isn't there something similar for the Arctic? So that they talk to each other, so that they know how many ships, especially not where there are docks, but where there are pristine areas, let's say on the east coast of Iceland. I'm sort of surprised that that's not addressed then by an association.
That's a good point. Did you, maybe, Peter, do you want to start since you've mentioned?
To my knowledge, then in the Antarctica, then you have a certain number of ships, and they have to follow very strictly a plan so they are not too far away from each other if something should go wrong, and they're not allowed to land more than so and so many people in the same place every day. So they try there to do something, not to disturb the local population, the penguins. And in a way, I would like that we could do the same in the Northern Hemisphere, because I think it's really time that we need to do it. On the other hand, one thing reminds me that most of these small ships, they are sold as luxury products or upmarket products. And every time we have a request for a private jet coming into Greenland, the first question is anybody else there at the same time? I've never had that question from a ship owning company.
So that's a question, though. What impact do we think this is going to have? We've been talking a lot about Iceland, but there's other areas of the world, too, that are going to be impacted by lots of ships. We see it in places like the Galapagos. We see it in Antarctica. There's, I'm sure we might say, everybody here in the room that's been in Europe. What impact, or are we seeing any changes in terms of the guests' experience that have changed how they're maybe in decisions that we're making?
Okay, I guess I'm getting my voice back. I think something which was not addressed, and I'd be very curious because there's some very shrewd cruise owners and ship operators and strategists here. What about the impact of all the Chinese tourists now in terms of their huge, huge new demand? We addressed this in an earlier session about them impacting a lot of tours in South Asia. I would imagine that you, if especially Ponant with its fleet and its growing fleet, you might be looking for Chinese charters. I'm just curious, what is the projected impact of the 1 billion Chinese travelers who many of them now are middle class, and of course, there many are billionaires.
That seems like that's a good one.
No, as far as Ponant is concerned, that's true that we have some demand from Chinese. We do maybe 2-3 charter a year, and it's only Antarctica. That's all. That's all. And we now we've stopped also groups because we cannot mix Chinese with the other. So we do maybe 2-3 charter a year, Antarctica. That's it.
So you're not looking to, you're looking to strictly work with this market on a charter basis, not
yes, charter basis, and mainly they're looking for expedition. Once we've done one in the Arctic, but we have no more demand for that. It's mainly Antarctica. Mm-hmm. But you asked also the question about IATO before. IATO for Antarctica, you've been to and you're asking about is there anything similar in the north? As far as I know, no, because, you know, Antarctica, this association has been built because Antarctica belongs to nobody. And that's why all the operators have worked to organize, you know, to avoid any problem, any mess. It's not the same in Arctic, you know. Arctic is part of countries, you know. So that's why we don't have any organization there, as far as I know. Because we're part of IATO, of course. But in Arctic, we deal with the local authorities.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, though, because as more and more ships are going into places, and for some of the cruise lines, it's the first time going into some of these destinations. Sometimes they've been there for a long time. But then with that, you know, what's the history there? What's the background? What are the important organizations that are there trying to establish some regulations? And I think that's where it's becoming a little bit of a Wild West territory until it gets sorted out. But what impact would we see that this could have on, does anybody as a group think this could change pricing? With all of these ships, would that affect, would the prices go down as a group, do you think? Or do we think that it's the demand will be expanded because it's going to reach different markets? The mention of Chinese markets was one that came up. Do we envision that the price will stay stable as a result of different channels?
Well, it depends on the
I'll give you the microphone.
Price and fluctuations will depend also on the fact that these costs, these ships, the new ships cost a lot of money. And even though the demand is
there, it's working, yes.
Yes.
Even though the demand is there, I think that ship owners still have to pay back for these new vessels, which cost a lot of money. So I don't think that we will see a drop in prices. That's my impression, especially because also your market, as you know, is considered by ship owners as the most lucrative market. This is, let's face it, this is a market where we know we can charge a bit more than what we charge to regular customers, FITs, and, mm-hmm. you know.
So when you say our market, do you mean the affinity market?
The affinity market, the affinity market.
Did you hear that? Everybody here, you're paying more.
I was going to say something. Hi, I'm Paula Pettengill. I work at Road Scholar. and I run their airline division. So my life is working with the airlines. So when I heard pricing, I was just like, that's my whole thing, is the airline pricing. And as you all know, what the airlines have done to us over the last, I've been with Rhodes Scholar for a very long time, it's not just about the price, right? There's all these ancillaries. So it used to be you pay this price for a seat on an airplane, and there you don't even have a seat anymore. You may have a ticket, but you don't have a seat. You may have a ticket and a seat, but you can't board unless you paid something. And so the fares are chopping things up. So I wonder if the cruise lines, you know, what you buy, it's not all or nothing. It'll be components of pricing or something, that you're buying pieces of things that will meet more people's interests like the airlines are trying to do.
An interesting perspective, for sure, as I said, I'm seeing a lot of head nodding at that as well. We have time for about a couple more, one or two more questions. I know there were some right here. You could say your name as well and your organization.
Gary Wilson from Coral Expeditions. Just addressing the tour operators that are chartering the ships. It's been our experience that, you know, the talk about things like plastic cups and straws and so on, sometimes it works the other way. You know, we've had groups come aboard the ship demanding plastic water bottles given to the guests every day, and that's something that we've never done. And then, you know, we get frowns, puzzled frowns, because we don't. You know, we have filtered water on the ship, and we have mugs, right, you know, rather than glasses. And it's, there's an expectation in the modern society. I mean, you see it here. You know, I notice here that everyone's handing out bottled water to the speakers. Give them a mug. Yeah. You know, there's an expectation that everyone has bottled water. So when we get a group come aboard our ships and say, well, actually, we don't do that, then there's a demand for it, and there's an expectation that we have to then provide it. So sometimes it works the other way as well.
That's a good point, for sure. Yeah. Other questions? I think there was one more back here. So as you can see, if we don't, this is just so much food for thought. We're about to hit this boom. We're all in it together. I think that we probably have come here where there's going to be more questions than answers, but hopefully we will continue the conversation both throughout the rest of the conference and then throughout, you know, when we're back in our desks, and really think and have it top of mind about the ships, the development, and how this can impact our constituency. So I want to thank you all for coming. I'd like a huge round of applause for Giannis, Variety Cruises, Daniel, Panant, Peter, Arctic Expeditions, and Sam as well from Conservation. And thank all of you for being here. There is an evaluation there. I know it would mean a lot to the ETC board if you could fill out the evaluation. There's somebody in the back to collect them, and then we can look at making it even better for next year. Thanks, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.